I can think about a physical activity and I can know that I can't do it. I can't jump. I can't jump. I don't understand the process that allows people to jump. And so if I just stand straight, I get like very little clearance off the ground. I would never try to run and jump over an object. Never. I don't understand the mechanics of jumping.
This is why I love reflex integration, because if we could integrate your reflexes, you'd be able to do that. And it sounds like a tiny thing, but when you can't do something that everybody else can do, it's really frustrating because you go, well, what's wrong with me? Why is it, I mean, and this is a typical story, I think, of adult diagnosis of ADHD and autism and dyslexia and everything, is you spend your whole life going, well, what's wrong with me? Why can everybody else do it and I can't do it? Clearly I'm a weirdo. But actually, no, it's just that actually you've got a neurodevelopmental issue and integrating reflexes can help.
Welcome to the Social Skills Unscripted podcast. I'm Steph, the founder and director of Starfish Social Club and Start a Social Club. I teach neurodivergent kids and teens how to make friends, and I teach people how to start a social club like mine in their own community. My goal with this podcast is to help you, the parents and teachers of neurodivergent kids and teens, learn strategies to help your kids develop social awareness at home, at school, in your clinic, wherever you may be out in the world. Here we go.
Hello and welcome back. This week, I am talking to Nikki McGlynn, who is, I have to look at my notes to remember this. This is actually something I'm not familiar with. So I'm really excited for this episode today because this is going to be a learning experience for me as well. Nikki is a neurodevelopment therapist, and she works with retained primitive reflexes to improve focus, attention, emotional regulation, sensory processing, and reduce anxiety. So anybody who's listening, I'm sure you heard at least one thing in that list that you would love some strategies, whether it's for your kiddo or for yourself. So on that note, Nikki, please tell us more about you and what you do.
So thank you so much for letting me come on your podcast. I really appreciate it. As you can tell, based in the UK. And I've worked with retained primitive reflexes for probably the last 7 or 8 years. And I got into it, as so many people do, I got into it because my daughter was diagnosed with dyslexia and then much later on as an adult with ADHD. But when she got her dyslexia diagnosis, I really wanted to do something to help her. I didn't want her to have the same experience of school that I'd had. I struggled all the way through school. I was lazy. I was disorganized. All those typical things that are leveled at people who are dyslexic. But I didn't have a diagnosis because I was at school in the 70s, 80s. So it was not really very well recognized. So I went specifically looking for something that would help her, discovered about primitive reflexes and the movement programs that can help encourage those reflexes to integrate.
And Nikki, can you explain more about what are primitive reflexes? What is it? What is it that we're even talking about?
So primitive reflexes are the biggest secret that have the biggest impact on people. The only primitive reflex that people are aware of is the Morrow reflex or the baby startle reflex. So people are familiar with that, where if you make a loud noise near your baby or you bump the cot, they do that kind of startle thing. And that's the Morrow reflex, and that's a primitive reflex. So essentially, primitive reflexes are movement patterns that all babies make all over the world, irrespective of race. They all do the same movements, and those movements allow the central nervous system to develop properly. So if those movements aren't fulfilled fully, so if for some reason the baby can't make those movements, or there are earlier reflexes that are retained, those reflexes, those movement patterns stay active in the body. And then that then interferes with mental, emotional, and physical development. So we can look for where those reflexes are retained physically. So how people sit, stand, move, you can see where those reflexes are in charge. But those reflexes will all have specific mental and emotional pictures as well. So, so for instance, going back to the Moro reflex, so the Moro reflex is a fear reflex. When it's retained in your system, it doesn't necessarily make you frightened, but it will stop you from feeling safe. So you have this pattern in your system that is completely subconscious that will prevent you from feeling safe in the world. So if you then don't feel safe in the world because of a reflex, then transitions are difficult. You know, I'm safe at home, I don't want to get in the car. I get in the car, I'm safe in the car, I don't want to get out of the car. So where you've got children who struggle to go to school, it's that transition from one environment to another that can be really problematic. But also we see in that Moro reflex, issues around holding on and letting go. So issues around relationships. We see problems with peer relationships. So often people who are very controlling is because they have a retained Moro reflex, because they need to be in charge because they don't feel safe. So, and there's essentially two parts to the Moro reflex. There's that startle, that sort of gasp, throwing their head back and their arms and legs back. And then there's a second stage, which is that clinging on, crying, you know, where you pick your baby up and it cries and you rock and go, they're there. And that then has that holding on, letting go, you know, that I need to hold on to you. No, I'm not going to hold on to you. And then that then translates into the fight flight mechanism. So where you have children and adults who go in between that fight flight, who are very aggressive or who run away, often it's because the Moro reflex sits behind it.
That's really fascinating. And this is the first time that I am hearing about something like this. So it's very interesting. Yeah. So how do you identify or know or diagnose if this is a challenge in somebody?
So like I say, you look really for, so when people come to see me, we'll do a consultation first. So I'll go through and ask questions about developmental issues.
Can I pause you?
Yeah.
What leads people to come see you? What would cause somebody to even contact you in the first place?
So really it's a chicken and egg thing. So people need to know that reflexes are an issue to then seek out somebody who works with reflexes. So which is why it's really important for me to come and do things like your podcast and as many of these kind of things as possible, because the more people who know that reflexes are an issue, the more people are going to come out and seek help and
absolutely,
you know, be able to help their children or help themselves. You know, this is the brain is plastic and changes at any age. So, you know, I work with children and I work with adults. So, and essentially, I talk about working with people with a diagnosis of ADHD, autism, dyslexia, dyspraxia, but you don't need to have a diagnosis, and it isn't a cure. You know, we're not looking to cure anybody. We're looking to improve their executive function, decrease their anxiety. So if we can integrate somebody's fear reflexes, then their life's going to be so much easier because they're not going to live in a world that feels dangerous. You know, so they're going to be able to go out, they're going to be able to socialize, they're going to be able to form relationships, because all of a sudden the world stops being quite such a scary place.
It's very interesting. Okay. Okay. So I cut you off when you were talking about your process when people come in, thank you for answering. Cause I absolutely agree that, we don't know what support to seek if we don't know what the issue is. So exactly. I absolutely agree with that it first has to start with understanding what exactly is the issue.
Yeah. And because nobody knows about reflexes, you know, doctors don't really know, nurses, health visitors, midwives, teachers. You know, this is new news to lots of people. And yet this isn't a new concept. This has been around since the 1950s. So now say doctors don't know about reflexes, then, you know, obviously they do know about reflexes because it's part of things that they check for. But it's the understanding the impact that those reflexes have beyond babyhood. You know, reflexes should be integrated by 12, 18 months. And yet I see adults who have massively retained reflexes, you know. So, and each reflex has a kind of a particular condition that it's more commonly associated with. So fear reflexes, you see anybody who's on the autistic spectrum has retained fear reflexes. Most people who have ADHD have retained fear reflexes. Dyslexia, dyspraxia, dyscalculia tend to be more associated with retained neck reflexes. ADHD also has a lot of issues with retained spinal reflexes. So when people come in and go, oh yes, my child has, you kind of know already what you're likely to be looking for reflex wise, but you don't need a diagnosis to do this work. You know, it's incredibly helpful for all sorts of things. So not just where we're looking at those processing issues or the neurodevelopment issues, but also things like chronic back pain or chronic neck pain or not being able to hit a golf ball in a straight line often can have a reflex issue behind it. So if you've got chronic neck pain and you go to a chiropractor, an osteopath, and you get your neck cracked, and then, you know, a week later the problem's back, often it's because that reflex isn't integrated. So your system isn't working as it should. So you're having to make those adjustments all the time, literally, to be able to keep upright. That's so you see it, you know, in kids at school. So there's a reflex called, they've all got really long names. There's a reflex called autonomic labyrinthine neck reflex, okay? Which a neck reflex is all about head position. So in babies, when their head goes forwards, their whole body collapses. When their head goes backwards, their body arches backwards, okay? So this is that neck reflex, okay? So I remember putting my children in the car seat, you know, to try and strap them in, and you'd put them in and they'd arch back and you'd think, oh my, just get in the car seat, and, you know, quick elbow in the solar plexus. But that was what it was that their head had moved beyond this midline, you know, that forwards, backwards midline. So that, and it's a reflex. So that whole body is involved in that arching backwards. So when you see that reflex retained, if you move your head forwards beyond this cut you in half midline, then your whole body wants to collapse. And it's not something that you logically have control of. It comes out of the brainstem. So you move your head forwards, your whole body wants to collapse. So this is when you see kids who, when they're trying to do their work, are kind of slumped on the desk because they've moved their head beyond that point. So their body wants to collapse. So they have this collapsing forwards, and then they look like they're not paying attention. So teachers go, sit up and pay attention. Well, they can sit up or they can pay attention. Can't do both because too much brain is involved in sitting upright because the overwhelming urge is to collapse. So, you know, and you have this issue with people who, you know, my big thing was going downstairs. I couldn't walk downstairs without holding on. Always had this feeling of falling, and this is this neck reflex, is that when you look down, your head moves forward, you have this sensation of collapsing forwards. So if you're walking downstairs or going downhill, it feels like you're going to collapse, so you have to hold on. So get that reflex to integrate, and all of a sudden you can be upright.
That, so I'm having a lot of personal connections to this conversation already. I think you talking about kind of the startle reflex, I'll just share what I have going on. And I would love to hear your take on it. I don't remember this always being the case, but for at least the last decade, I would say I have a significant startle reflex.
Okay.
So any type of loud, unexpected noise, and my body has such a strong reaction to it. So right now, if something were to fall on the floor, you know, any kind of just sudden loud noise, I have such a strong physical reaction to it. The reason I know it's been at least a decade is because when I was married, my husband used to think it was hilarious, but it actually, it's very distressing. Yeah. It, whenever it happens, it, my whole body like goes into alert mode. It's very distressful for my body when that happens. And it takes me a bit. I mean, it could be a noise that, like I said, something falling. That's a 1 second thing, but it takes me a while for my body to re-regulate. And it can happen multiple times in a day. It also happens when people enter my line of vision unexpectedly. And that's what my husband used to really make fun of me about, that because we lived in a house together and he would come around the corner and I would just have this visceral physical reaction to him startling me. And he would joke that we're different races. So he would always make it a racial joke. It's so uncontrollable when something unexpected, it's a loud noise or it's something that comes into my, it doesn't even have to be a person, just something that comes into my line of vision. And I just have such this visceral startle reflex. I also have really poor coordination, even though I'm very physically active. And you talking about that's, I'll have to try that with my neck down. I've never noticed that I feel like I'm going to fall down things, but I do definitely notice that I can't move as easily as other people. If I'm hiking, for example, Christmas, I was in another state and I had done this hike way up on a mountain and I got to the top and it was very steep and there were kids up there. There were dogs up there. There were all kinds of people just hanging out. And I was convinced that somebody was going to fall because when I'm up there, to me, everything is so steep and unstable, and I'm convinced that somebody is going to fall off the edge, but nobody else was fazed. There were a lot of people up there and nobody, I had to get down, not because I was afraid of me. I was like, somebody is going to fall. But I could also tell that I was the only person who was worried about that. And I even Googled it, like how many people have fallen off this mountain? And there was like one, you know, and cause I was like, surely this has to happen once a week. So I just with me, I have a lot of weird physical things like that, that I just wonder like, what is this? Where's I also, you were talking about, the once a week, anytime I get a massage, the next day it's completely undone. Within a day, everything feels the same way that it did before. It's mainly my neck. I have TMJ in my jaw. So I am kind of a mess, physically speaking. I sometimes joke that I was put together too quickly and I just don't work properly.
So you need to find somebody who does reflex integration. So okay. that you're talking about, so we've talked at the beginning about sensory processing. So that's a Moro issue. Okay. So where people have sensory processing problems, sensory processing disorder, that's a retained Moro reflex. So that exactly what you're saying, that somebody comes in your line of vision. This is about survival.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is not a logical thing. Mm-hmm. This is a hindbrain survival limbic issue. Okay, so there's no kind of executive processing here. This is right. About survival. So, and it's a reflex. So it's something you have no control over at all, and that's absolutely. Why it takes so long to re-regulate from it, is because your poor little brain has gone, oh my God, we're going to get killed. You know, somebody's come into your line of vision suddenly, your immediate feeling is that you're going to die.
Yes. It's, yeah.
And because you see it all over the internet, you know, these videos of people, you know, being frightened. Mm-hmm. Somebody comes up with a horn or a whatever and frightens people. And, oh, it's hilarious. Ha, ha, ha. But actually, yes. For that person, they think they're going to die.
That's it. People, I cannot handle people intentionally, like jump scare, right? That's like a thing that I cannot handle that because to me, it's not funny. It's not funny. It floods my body with adrenaline.
It's
very hungry. It also makes me emotionally upset that I have such a large reaction. Yeah. So if there's a physical reaction and then I become emotional because it's so uncomfortable that I react that way.
So go back to a baby. So the baby gets a fright. So they go, so that's your jump scare. And then the next thing they do is they cling on and they cry. So that's why you then have that emotional response, is because that's the two parts of that reflex, that, oh my God, I'm going to die. Save me, save me, save me.
Wow. Fascinating. Okay.
Okay. So, and how you check for the morrow is precisely that. You look to see if somebody has if you wave your hand in front of their face, do they react? If they fall back into your arms, do they jump? If you tap them, do they jump? You know, if you bang the floor next to them, do they jump? If you pull their legs away, do they jump? So it's about your sensory processing being over acute because inside, you feel like you could die at any point. You're not safe. The world is not a safe place. And how do you know if you're going to get attacked? If you see them, if you hear them, if they grab you, you know, they're all ways to that your body goes, we're under attack, we're under attack. Mm-hmm. So it's a survival thing. It's just inappropriate.
Yes, so absolutely.
You know, and then, so that's the morrow reflex, which is all fight flight. Preceding the morrow reflex is the fear paralysis reflex, which is the first reflex to develop, and it develops and it should integrate in utero. So the morrow reflex, primitive reflexes develop in utero and mature outside of the womb. Okay. So the morrow reflex starts in utero and should have integrated by about 3 months. So this should have gone away by about 3 months. These reflexes
well, 40 years ago, this
should they can reemerge with trauma. So if you've had something very traumatic happen, car accident, you know, or various other traumas that we deal with, these reflexes can reemerge because they're part of our survival mechanism.
I think that it's tied to, I had a situation as an adult, maybe 15 years ago, where I had a situation with a person in my life who made me feel very unsafe. And that's exactly when I see that about people coming, that's exactly what when I have a second to process, I think it's him. Yeah. And so I don't remember it being so severe before that time in my life, but I do. And the same with my physical posture. My physical posture has tanked. And I feel like it all started to happen around that time that this was happening in my personal life. But I have related it to that I don't ever think about that situation anymore on a daily basis.
But your body does.
Yeah.
You know, it's stuck in your body, you know, and we know so much more now about trauma and about how those things get dumped into our physical system to deal with later, or they never get dealt with.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that that person was never a physical threat to me. There, I was never in physical danger. It was just a lot of emotional trauma and that kind of stuff. But I became so afraid of just seeing him out in the world because that actually happened one time. And so I think that, you know, it's so weird that it comes out as a physical response because I wasn't physically afraid. I just, I was emotionally and mentally afraid of encountering that person again.
So your body doesn't know the difference.
Yeah. Very
you
true.
You don't feel safe. Yeah. So if you don't feel safe, you have to run away or you have to fight. We have to freeze, you know, which is your fear paralysis reflex, you know, which shuts down your whole system, stops you being able to do anything. So you know, and then that comes out, you know, like where people are assaulted and they don't say anything and they don't mm-hmm. shout out. It's because they're the deepest parts of their brain have gone. The best way to deal with this is to not react. Mm-hmm. The safest, we can't fight, we can't run away, we just won't react. So you're going to freeze.
Yeah.
So it's, all of those things are about survival.
Yeah. It's so interesting in how it gets so misunderstood, right? Even the example you were just giving of someone who doesn't respond in a dangerous situation, or, you know, it's so interesting how there are biological reasons.
Absolutely. You know, we're cavemen living in a 21st century world. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
It's not working.
The world is progressing much faster than our bodies are able to Absolutely. Keep up with. Yeah. So I know that you have some thoughts about just some simple things that can make a big difference. So what are some of the things that you suggest for people who are struggling with some of these challenges?
So there's quite a lot around on the internet. I think the most important thing is that movement develops the brain. If we don't move, our brains can't develop. And I think for babies, so any new mums who are listening, and I always feel bad for new mums because they're given so much advice from everybody all the time. But for babies, the best thing for babies is to be on their tummies on the floor. You know, put them on their tummies on the floor with some stuff around them, leave them alone. They need to get on with it. They'll be fine. But this whole thing now where babies spend all their time on their backs. So if you're lying on your tummy and your tummy is covered by you, then that feels much safer. You know, we feel, you know, we talk about curling into the fetal position. That's a safe place to be. If you're a baby on your back all the time, every noise, everything will trigger that moro. So, you know, I mean, I remember seeing my babies do it. They'd be on their backs in their cot and, you know, you'd turn the light on or you'd walk past too heavily and they'd jump. And then that stops that reflex from being able to integrate. So that's one of the reasons why we have a problem. So, you know, babies need to be on their tummies. So if they're on their tummies, that reflex has a better chance of integrating. They also have the opportunity to get control of their head. So, you know, we're talking about this reflex. So if you're on your back, you can't move your head in the same way. Whereas if you're on mm-hmm. your tummy, you know, babies do that sort of pecking thing. And mm-hmm. that's them getting control of their head and getting control of their necks, and then being able to get proper control of their muscles and organization of their whole body. So, and then similarly, if they're lying on their tummies, and when you're breastfeeding as well, so this is another one for mums of babies, if you're bottle feeding your baby, then turn its head so that it's in the same position it would be in as if you were breastfeeding.
Okay.
If you're breastfeeding your baby, one eye and one ear is covered.
Okay.
If a baby's lying on its tummy, one eye and one ear is covered. And then if they turn their head the other way, the other eye and the other ear is covered. So that way, babies learn that they've got two eyes, two ears. They need to work together to be able to see properly, to be able to read, to be able to hear properly, to be able to locate where sound's coming from. When they're on their back, none of that happens. So they don't learn to control their eyes properly. So, you know, so we get more and more problems. And then this is the other neck reflex, or another neck reflex, with this side to side, left to right. So this is your asymmetric tonic neck reflex. So if this reflex is retained, when you turn your head to the side, the side you're turning your head to, the arm and the leg on that side want to extend, and the arm and the leg on the opposite side want to come in. So you get this kind of movement. Okay, you've probably seen it in babies. So if that reflex is retained in adults, what happens is when you turn your head to the side, this arm wants to come out and this arm wants to come in. So if you're driving and you look out the window, or you look over your shoulder, you'll swerve.
Because... Oh my goodness, I do. So I'm a cyclist and I am incapable of turning and looking over my shoulder because who knows where I will end up. I may fall. That is so interesting.
And that's why.
Like, what is that? And even when you say, if you turn your head to the side, your arm wants to go out. I don't feel that at all. When I turn my head to the side, my arm has no.
So put your arms out in front of you now. Put your arms out in front of you. Okay. So just relax your shoulders. Okay. Bring your arms up a little bit because I can't see them. Okay. Right. So slowly turn your head to the left. Okay. And slowly turn your head to the right and to the left. And to the right. Can you see what your arms are doing?
No.
They're going like this.
Are they supposed to be going like that? No, she says no.
So, and what they're also doing is they're doing this, which you couldn't see because you were moving your head, but it's this drift out. So, yeah. So that's how you look from...
Okay.
So that reflex gives you problems with handwriting because what happens is your brain can't cope with going from one side to the other, you know, so this hemisphere works this side, this hemisphere works this side. So when you're writing, you tend to try and keep everything in one side of the body so that you don't have to switch between the two. So, and then it can give you real problems with handwriting, it can give you problems with your arm, it can give you stiff shoulders, it can give you stiff neck, all of those kind, any kind of left-right issues tend to be, call it ATNR for short, but also processing. So neck reflexes really affect processing. So this is dyslexia, dyspraxia, dyscalculia.
Interesting, very interesting.
So then to get that reflex working well, you or integrating is you need to do cross body things. So crawling, climbing, you know, climbing is crawling on a different plane. So anything that involves going across your body. So, and that will help with that reflex. So dancing is really, really good for brain development.
I'm really uncoordinated, and it's surprising. I actually am a triathlete, but everything in triathlon goes in a straight line. And so I can swim in a straight line. I can bike in a straight line. Straight, obviously you're turning and curves and stuff, but
what stroke do you swim with?
I don't even know what you call it. Just the, cool. This one, but I'm not a great swimmer.
Can you do this one?
No.
No. And that's why.
Because of my coordination.
Because of your reflexes.
And I can think about a physical activity and I can know that I can't do it. Can't jump.
Yeah.
I can't jump. I don't understand the process that allows people to jump. And so if I just stand straight, I get like very little clearance off the ground. I would never try to run and jump over an object. Never. I don't understand the mechanics of jumping.
This is why I love reflex integration, because if we could integrate your reflexes, you'd be able to do that. And it sounds like a tiny thing, but when you can't do something that everybody else can do, it's really frustrating because you go, what's wrong with me? Why is it, you know, I mean, and this is a typical story, I think, of adult diagnosis of ADHD and autism and dyslexia and everything, is you spend your whole life going, well, what's wrong with me? Why can everybody else do it and I can't do it? You know, clearly I'm a weirdo. But actually, no, it's just that actually you've got a neurodevelopmental issue and integrating reflexes can help.
That is so interesting. So basically everything that we've talked about so far, I'm struggling with.
That's so interesting. You've been any better, me too.
Okay.
And I'm not a triathlete.
It does make me feel better. When you were talking earlier about babies being on their stomach, it gave me the mental image of a turtle.
and just kind of, and even when you were talking about how when they're laying on their stomach, they feel it's protected, right? But if you're on your back, you're exposed. And it just gave me the mental image of a turtle, that as long as a turtle is, right, stomach down, it's totally fine. But once you turn him over, he's flailing and you know, yeah. That was just a side note about that, that it just.
Yeah. And that, you know, and that's exactly it, isn't it? You want to feel safe. So, you know, I'm a big fan of baby wearing, you know, but not the outward facing slings. You know, babies don't need to see the world. They need to feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
So you wrap them up in a carrier, in a sling, keep them close to you. And of course, movement develops the brain. So mm-hmm. whether you're moving or whether your baby's moving, that movement, you know, that moving, if you've got your baby on you and you're doing housework or walking or whatever, that rhythm helps with brain development and it helps develop their vestibular system. So your vestibular system, your balance system, is the first sense that develops in utero, and everything else hangs on that. So if you're pregnant, so, you know, my daughter, bless her, you know, I mean, she's doing amazingly now, but, you know, we struggled a lot. But when I was pregnant with her, I had hyperemesis. So I was in bed most of the time or in hospital because I was so sick all the time. So I didn't move, you know, and I'm sure that had some impact on her, because when you're moving around, when you're pregnant and baby's moving around, that's helping to develop that system. If you're then wearing your baby and doing things, then that also helps develop that balance system. And that balance system allows everything else, all those other senses and all of that proprioception, you know, where am I in space, interoception, what's going on inside of me, to develop well. So,
that's,
yeah.
Wow, that's really, I've never thought of that before, but I can, everything that you're saying, I can visualize, and I can visualize, you know, the baby developing, and by you moving, you're strengthening its ability to handle movement, right? Because what I can picture when you're talking about that is when you were talking about you not moving that much because you were, you know, ill, I can picture your baby just getting used to things being still and calm. And so then when you do start moving, it's like seasickness, right? It's like, I don't know if this is an accurate description, but that's how I can picture it when you're talking about it.
You see, for a baby, it's not still and calm. For a baby, you know, it's the moving that babies need. It's that rhythm. You know, I mostly use a system called rhythmic movement training, and it's the rhythm that allows the brain to develop. You know, we are rhythmic creatures. In, you know, when you're inside, it's the rhythm of the heart, the rhythm of the breathing, the rhythm of digestion. And then when babies are born, you know, we rock them rhythmically. You know, rhythm is so important to us, and rhythm makes such a difference to brain development. So, you know, and all those things that we used to do, I don't know so much about in the States, but here, you know, nursery rhymes and things that we used to do with our children that we don't do so much anymore is rhythm and moving and stimulating different parts of the body. You know, we I don't know if you do round and round the garden over there, but we would do round and round the garden in the palm of your hand, round and round the garden.
Like, yeah, I don't think so.
So that's hand reflexes. You know, doing that helps to develop the hand reflexes. This little piggy went to market, which you do on with the toes, on the feet, that helps you to develop foot reflexes. You know, all of those rhyming games that we used to do with our children, or, you know, not so much these days, all help to develop reflexes. And we had no idea, you know, we just thought they were songs.
Mm-hmm.
But they all help to teach babies and children where they are in the world, where they start, where they finish, where their hands are, where their feet are, where their legs are. You know, this is you in the world. And we don't do that anymore. And so the kids don't get that kind of, and then we have children who grow up with sensory processing issues, or, you know, proprioceptive issues. You know, they can't tolerate different fabrics, they can't tolerate labels, all of these kind of things we can help with, you know. So something really, really simple, like tapping rhythmically on your child, pick a rhythm, tap all over, you know, tap arms, legs, head, everything. And that helps teach the child where it is, you know, where is my front, where is my back. The whole thing with weighted blankets, which are brilliant. But what they do is they give the brain proprioceptive feedback. When you have a weighted blanket on you, you've got information constantly from your body telling your brain where you are. Here I am, here I am, here I am. But so you don't need to do that. You can do that by tapping. You can go, you know, here I am. This is my, and kids who tap all the time and adults who tap all the time, you know, often that's what they're looking for. They're looking for that proprioceptive feedback. Where's my body? Where's my hand? Where's my foot? Where's my leg?
And I think I've seen kids in school that walk down the hallway dragging their fingers on the wall. And to me, that's how I see it, is they're seeking input.
Yeah.
Or sometimes you'll see kids that if they're walking close to a wall, they keep bumping into it.
Yeah.
And it's they're not even doing it consciously. It's just their way of checking where they are in space.
Exactly. So, you know, so if you've got a kid who does that, tap them every day, tap them front, back, all over, pick a rhythm, do that rhythm every day. And their brains go, okay, here I am.
Okay.
I think there's a thing nowadays where we treat our children like small adults without the understanding that they're children and their brains have to develop. And we have to give them the input to develop. Because without that, you know, it doesn't help happen. I think on my notes to you, I said one of the best things you can do, best things you can do for brain development is rolling down a hill. Rolling down a hill. You've got all of that proprioceptive input as you go over and over and over and get squished against the floor. You've got all that vestibular input from spinning. You've got that input into your hearing and your balance and into your eyes. And it's fun.
Yeah. That's awesome. I think too, another thing that I think is really tied to this is kids who, so kind of like the bumping into the walls, but like slamming doors, right? Kids who slam doors, not because they're trying to slam the door, but because they have no sense of how much strength or weight or effort to put into opening and closing. Kids who can't open bottles, or open, you know, like their little lunch packs, they can't peel the label off. Right. I think a lot of this, just the physical awkwardness that you may see in somebody, because that's how I feel about myself. I feel like I'm physically awkward. But I think it's, the door slamming one is one that sticks in my mind because it triggers my own, right? Whenever kids are slamming doors, I'm like, but I also recognize that they have no ability to regulate that. I think the same with the volume of kids' voices sometimes, right? It's just inability to recognize and regulate the volume at which you're speaking.
All of that regulation stuff it is a reflex thing. You know, this could all be improved, it's not an intellectual thing, it's a physical thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, going to the park, you know, going on swings and swinging in the park and going on roundabouts and going on slides and climbing frames and hanging upside down and climbing up things, you know, all of that stuff develops your brain, you know. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing I try and get over to parents is the more that they play, the more that helps with brain development. You know, it's not just about physical stuff. It's about, mm-hmm. you know, because there's a whole phenomenon now with kids falling off chairs. They sit on the chair and they fall off because they don't have the wherewithal to stay on a chair. They just fall off, you know, mm-hmm. and that's because these reflexes that should hold them upright, hold them still, aren't there.
That's interesting. You know, I hadn't heard that about falling off of chairs.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
You know, walking into people and bumping into people and kids feeling oversensitive, you know, he hit me when they didn't, and kids not understanding that this is too much and not enough. You know, all of that proprioceptive stuff. How I exist in the world, and it's all reflex stuff, and it can all be really improved, you know. So rather than just tell them, you know, roll them down a hill. Tap them, you know, teach them a musical instrument. All of that stuff is going to be helpful, you know. And the problem as well with particularly when the neck reflexes are retained, kids don't want to do sports. They don't want to go out and do things because, like you were saying, you know, they feel clumsy. They don't feel they've got coordination in their body. They can't do climbing. They can't do handstands and cartwheels. They can't hit a ball in a straight line. They can't catch, you know, that hand-eye coordination. That's a neck reflex issue. Being able to hit a ball, that's a neck reflex issue. So all of these issues that if we can encourage those reflexes to integrate, those issues will improve. But of course, by doing exercise improves those reflexes. So you get in this sort of catch 22 thing. So you have to keep it small and safe and easy and achievable, you know. And when you've got kids who are neurodiverse, they spend a huge amount of time failing. All they ever do is fail, and they get into trouble. And, you know, like we were saying about adults, you know, you spend your whole life thinking, what's wrong with me? It's the same with these kids, you know. They're getting in trouble. They can't sit still. They can't pay attention. They can't sit up straight. So they're constantly being told off. So they feel like a failure. Their self-esteem's on the floor. But we can do something to make it better. And it's simple, you know, and it's cheap. You don't need equipment. You just need to get that movement going. You know, singing and dancing and playing will help all of that work. And if that isn't helping, then you go and see somebody like me.
Yeah, this is so fascinating. And just to piggyback on what you're saying about sports, I have no understanding of how people can play a sport like baseball or softball. I have no ability to catch something that small being thrown my way. I also can't throw things that have any weight to them. I can't figure out the hand-eye coordination and the timing to be able to hit a ball coming at me. Even with soccer, I played soccer as a kid. And the joke is that I didn't actually play soccer. I climbed trees because I cannot coordinate a ball coming at my foot with me then kicking that ball. And again, like, I'm a triathlete. I've been a triathlete for 10 years, but it's because that is all moving forward. It's there's nothing coming at me that I have to respond to. I think responsiveness is a big issue for me too, physically. If there's something happening to me, even when I first started learning how to ride my bike competitively, if there was something in the road, I would not be able to respond. So if there was something in the road that I was going to hit, and I would try to go around it, I would overcorrect and fall over. Like I couldn't even figure out how to regulate how much to turn the wheel. So I just went around this thing in the road. It's so interesting. So I have found swimming, biking, and running for me personally have been running is awkward for me. I hate looking at photos of me running. They're that classic meme example, right? What I think I look like when I'm running and what I actually look like. But swimming and cycling, I think, have been really great for me. Cycling is my favorite thing to do because it doesn't actually require, once you learn how to ride a bike without training wheels, right? However old you are when that happens, it doesn't require that much coordination past that point. You just have to go fast enough that you're not falling over, and you have to be able to maneuver, you know, as opposed to mountain biking, which absolutely not. No, that is not for me. I have no ability to go around obstacles and, you know, things like that. But I think there are definitely, you know, martial arts, I think is another. There are definitely sports that don't require as much reaction and coordination. I think martial arts is a really good one to build some of those.
Martial arts are really, really good because, and really anything that's going across the body is going to be good, because then you're getting those two hemispheres, you know, so you're getting those two hemispheres to work together to go across the body.
Yeah.
So what you're doing, everything stays on the same side. So although you're moving opposite arms and legs, nothing's going across.
Correct. Yes.
Everything stays in the middle.
Yes. Yeah. And I do from, I know that's an occupational therapy thing too, is crossing the body. And I've even worked with kids on that, because one of the things that I know happens when kids struggle, and I see it with me a little bit, but you talked about writing, and kids who struggle with that, they're not able to line up along the left line. And so they often end up, as they go down the page, at a diagonal. Yeah. Right. And so I've
recognized asymmetric tonic neck reflex.
Yeah. And so I know, you know, drawing rainbows on the board and just those things that do the cross body.
But the problem that you've got, the problem that you have personally, and the problem that we have with this work is that reflexes develop sequentially. So if you have a retained Moro reflex, your neck reflexes are going to struggle to integrate because they come later.
Okay.
So you have to focus on the Moro reflex, maybe the fear paralysis reflex first.
Okay.
Before you start worrying about the neck reflexes, really.
Okay. That's so important to know. Okay. Yeah.
So it doesn't mean that you can't improve it, but it's just, you know, you're only going to go so far, because, and particularly the Moro reflex, you know, it does act as a bit of a gateway. Mm-hmm. That, you know, and when people come in and they've got retained fear reflexes, I know without even having to test anything that all of their other reflexes are likely to be retained. And then when we do test them, often we test them as much for the parents to see as for me to check, because parents need to know, you know, they need to be able to see that actually you can't move your head without the rest of your body moving. You can't move your head from side to side without your arms going. You can't go on your hands and knees and put your head down without collapsing, you know, and the spinal gland, which we haven't talked about, is a spinal reflex. And it runs either side of the lower spine. And for many people where it's retained, if you stimulate it, they'll jump on one side. So like one hip will jump and one shoulder will jump. But sometimes you don't see a reaction at all. And that's because the reflex hasn't actually properly developed. So you check it and you go, well, that's weird, because you've got all these symptoms, so that reflex should be there. But actually it's not there because it hasn't established itself properly. And that reflex, that spinal reflex, interferes with your ability to listen. So, you know, sometimes parents bring their children to me and they go, we've had his hearing checked, but there seems to be a problem. The problem is his hearing, his problem is his listening.
Mm-hmm.
And babies, when they're developing in the womb, their spines conduct sound up to the brain. So after you're born, your ears should take over. But if that spinal reflex is still active, then your spine is trying to conduct noise up to the brain and your ears are trying to conduct noise over to the brain. So then it's too much input. So you stop listening. So you see that in kids who, if something happens behind them, they have to turn and look. Somebody drops a pen, you have to turn and look because it's behind them. And they can't cope with things around their waist. So those kids who push their trousers down or pull their trousers up really high, because anything around that lower lumbar is irritating. So they can't sit with their backs against the chair. So you've got those kind of typical teenagers with their trousers down by their hips and they're slumped on their chair, you know, with their arms folded and they're rocking, because if that reflex is active, you can't be still. You have to move. You have to move constantly, constantly, constantly. So, you know, you see it in adults.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly the same. Exactly the same. So, you know, that reflex, I think, is a real handicap. And that's our kind of typical ADHD reflex. But that really only covers your hyperactive ADHD people, not your inattentive ADHD people.
Mm-hmm. That's so fascinating. I think, and tagging onto what you were saying about how they develop in sequence, and so you can't really support the later ones if you haven't addressed the earlier ones. I think it reminds me a lot of how things progress socially as well. And I think one of the things that if you come across a kid who is 5 versus a kid who's 15. From an academic perspective, you do not expect this 5-year-old to be able to read. You're actually kind of surprised if they can, right? You don't expect them to be able to multiply, all these things that would not be age appropriate, but the 15-year-old you do, right? You expect them to be able to be reading chapter books, novels. You expect them to be able to be doing algebra, you know, that kind of thing. And I think with social, there's not really a chance for kids to develop social. And so when you get to be 8 years old, 12 years old, like if you're struggling with social, it's like there's no remedial social class that you can go to. Like you can go to a remedial reading class. I used to teach kids who didn't know how to read, right? I've taught adults how to read who never learned how to read, but with social, it's not so black and white that it's, you know, you start here, you know, this is the first thing we learn. But in my program, I have broken it down that way. And we don't get to friendships until the very end of the program, because it's so similar to what you're saying about the different states, that if your kiddo is struggling with social relationships, it's not because they're missing the things at the end. It's because they're missing the things at the beginning. Yes. They're missing, like, the first part of my program is about understanding that other people have thoughts about us and that we can influence those thoughts by the things we say and the things we do. And that we are probably creating a reputation that we may not even want to have, but it's because of the things we're saying and doing, and that we can, and just being more socially aware of other kids. And I mean, it's so interesting how I can't meet a new kid who's struggling to make friends and in 30 minutes teach them how to make friends, because there's so much more that they haven't learned or just don't know.
And if you're a kid who's all up in their fear reflexes, so the world is not a safe place, it's really hard to get over that barrier of feeling that actually you can interact with this person. And if you've got, you know, so your Moro reflex is all that control, because I have to be in control of everything because it's not safe. But your fear paralysis kids can't, you know, this whole thing about selective mutism, it's not selective, it's not a choice. You don't select not to speak. Your vocal cords are paralyzed because that fear paralysis reflex has shut everything down. You can't make eye contact, you can't look at somebody, you can't speak. You know, I mean, it's agony for these kids.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, 3 years of pandemic has made all of that so much worse.
You know, that's interesting talking about selective mutism. I've had several kids in my program that experience that. And it's there's so much anxiety behind that, right? You're right. It's not just that I don't like you and I don't want to talk to you. It's like I physically cannot. Yes. Yeah. And it's interesting. One of the really cool things about my program is kids can stay for as long as they choose to. And so I have kids for years sometimes, and to be able to see their progress, especially with something like selective mutism. But I can also see how there's sometimes where, you know, I've had a kiddo start crying before when he's in a situation where he wants to engage, he wants to communicate, but there's so much anxiety around it.
That's all that prefrontal. I want to engage, you know, prefrontal limbic system. I want to engage. I want to be your friend. But the stuff at the back is going, it's not safe. You can't talk to anybody because it's not safe. You have to stay at home and don't leave your room.
Well, and that's my big thing about when somebody says that their kid is shy, is I don't believe in shy. I believe that shy is social anxiety, which is different from being introverted, right? Shy is not introverted, but I don't believe there's such a thing as shy. I believe, I think a lot of people struggle with social anxiety. I think it's kind of a natural byproduct, you know, of our society. But for some people, it's such an issue that it interferes with their ability to function.
And this is the thing, though, isn't it? It's a natural byproduct of our society. Why? Why has that become a thing? And why do we accept it? Why are we not going, what's changed in the last 25, 30 years that we have this epidemic of social anxiety? Mm-hmm. You know, is it simply because we put our kids to bed on their backs? Is it because we put them to bed on their backs? We put them in car seats. We put them under baby gyms. We put them, kids spend all their time on their backs. Their motor reflexes can't integrate. They are living in their fear reflexes. Wouldn't it be amazing if it was that simple?
It's interesting because sometimes I'll have kids where I can tell they've developed social anxiety because they've had just really negative social interactions, and it's a cumulative effect. But for most of the kids, other kids like them. Other kids enjoy them. The kids aren't making fun of them for what they say or what they look like. And so for most of the kids I work with that have social anxiety, it's not based in anything that's actually happened before. It's so interesting when I come across those kinds of situations where it's so built up in their minds, but it's not based on anything that's actually happened. Yeah. It's a reflex issue.
It's a feeling. It's a survival instinct that's become overblown.
Yeah, that's so interesting. This has been such a fascinating conversation, Nikki. Thank you so much for this conversation. Obviously, it's been a little bit of diagnostic and diagnosis and therapy for me as I check all the boxes, apparently. But I think I'm glad to be able to demonstrate that because I'm a pretty darn functional person. And so I think it's interesting to be able to see that you can be functional and still struggle with things like this on a regular
100%, 100%.
basis.
You know, human beings are incredibly adaptable, but I think, you know, we talk about the autistic spectrum, but everything's on a spectrum, you know, so there's an ADHD spectrum, a dyslexia spectrum, an autistic spectrum. And similarly with reflexes, you know, people can have their reflexes retained a bit, or they can have them retained a lot. You know, you can have them retained on one side, you can have them retained on both sides. I think we just like things to be black and white, and people are so much more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, and within all of this, there's lots and lots of room to maneuver.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Before we go, Nikki, is there anything else that you want to share?
I don't think so. I don't know. What have we missed?
I think this has been an amazing conversation. I'm really glad that you're here. And I would also, to everybody who's listening, like to give a special thank you to Nikki. Because I scheduled this interview very last minute and then changed it on her. So I really, really appreciate you, Nikki, for just being so flexible and adaptable with me. That's kind of how I live my life, but I learned that most people don't. So I really appreciate you.
That's okay, because I do.
Okay. That's why we get along so well. So yeah, thank you. Thank you for all of that. And where can people find you online?
So my company is Organized Mind with an S, not a Z, because I'm in the UK.
Okay. Organized Mind with an S. I'll put it in the notes, but thank you for pointing that out.
Okay. And I have a Facebook page, and on my Facebook page, there's quite a few videos. And then on my website, there's a like a mini course, like a lecture. Okay. Of me being terribly serious and grown up, which talks about each reflex in turn. So if you want to get a really good understanding of what the reflexes are, then that's and I think it's pretty accessible. So that's on my website, which is organizedmind.co.uk.
Okay.
And, you know, and obviously, if the majority of your audience is in the States, you know, I'm limited what I can do to help, but I'm always happy to answer any questions. So, and over there, the rhythmic movement training is available in the States. There's also the big one over there at the moment is Brain Balance, which is Robert Melio, his program. And I think that's probably the most sort of common one to access. That has quite a different approach. There's lots of different approaches to reflex integration. MNRI is also available over there, which is Svetlana Muskatova's program. And the Institute for Human Potential, which is kind of where it all started, which has a very different perspective. So there's actually loads. They're sort of the big ones. There's hundreds of reflex integration programs. If you were looking for reflex integration, then I would search in your local area or I would ask in local Facebook groups. You know, okay. Often if you say anybody know anybody who deals with reflex integration, then there will be people locally who have been to see somebody or can point you in the right direction for somebody. And that, I think, is probably your best option.
Okay. Amazing. Amazing. Thank you so much. To everybody who's listening, thank you for being here. I'm really glad that you're here. And I'll see you again next week. Thank you, as always, for joining me. If you aren't already part of my community, you can find me at starfishsocialclub.org. There you can join my email list, find some free resources to help with your kiddos, join the waiting list for my program, and learn how I can help you start your own club like mine. I'll see you there.